The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
You got a little more energy in you? A little bit? All right. I wanted to give you something. Have a seat again, just for a second. This is something you pick up in Masada, so I asked them and they gave me copies for you. This tells the story of Masada, tells you a little bit about some of the things we saw, and it has an excerpt of Elazar ben Yair's last speech, you know? And I want to read you this speech, and then I'll give it to you. Since we long ago, my generous friends, resolved never to be servants to the Romans, nor to any other than to God himself, who alone is the true and just God of mankind. The time has now come that obliges us to make that resolution true in practice. Let us not at this time bring a reproach upon ourselves for self-contradiction. Let us not undergo slavery. Let us not now, together with slavery, choose such punishments also as are intolerable. I mean this upon the supposition that the Romans once reduced us under their power while we are alive. We were the very first that revolted from them, and we are the last that fight against them. And I cannot but esteem it as a favor that God has granted us, that it is still in our power to die bravely and in a state of freedom, which has not been the case of others, who were conquered unexpectedly. It is very plain that we shall be taken within a day's time. But it is still an eligible thing to die, after a glorious manner, together with our dearest friends. That our wives die before they are abused, and our children before they have tasted slavery. And after we have slain them, let us bestow that glorious benefit upon one another mutually, and preserve ourselves in freedom as an excellent funeral monument for us. But first let us destroy our money in the fortress by fire, for I am well assured that this will be a great relief to the Romans, that they shall not be able to seize upon our bodies, and shall fail to our wealth also. And let us spare nothing but our provisions, for they will be a testimony when we are dead, that we are not subdued for want of necessaries, but that according to our original resolution, we have preferred death before slavery. This is quoted from Josephus, and Josephus wrote this. Big debate whether this speech was somehow written down, or whether Josephus recorded what these two women told him, and therefore it's spirit of what he said, but not the exact words. Big debate. Okay, come follow me, I got a treat for you. By the way, if you ever hear of people doing a bar mitzvah on the side of this, this is where they do it. That's why they have all these chairs here. Yeah. It's really an amazing experience. Yeah, I'm just stopping here for a second just because we're catching our breath, but this is not what I want to show you. You'll see this all over the place. There's another bigger one in the wall over there. What they know about this is that this held pigeons. What they're not sure about is whether that's because they ate them, they breeded them and ate them, or because they used them as messengers, or because they were part of their ritual as pagan idolatry, or all of the above. Romans. This was Roman and later used by the Byzantines. This is not Jewish. No, this was actually built in the time early on of Herod. Okay? And the Romans used this as well. This was probably his, you know. Wow. Just so you know, this is actually proof that this is an ongoing archaeological site. Underneath the ground where we're standing is the largest cistern on Masada. Okay, this stairway goes down about 150 yards and into a huge, huge cavern. The walls are very smooth because they were once filled with water. It's a huge pool of water down here. Okay, it's not actual water today, and I'll explain that when we're back in the bus in the air conditioning. But I was going to take you down there and tell you the story of the water. So I'll tell it to you on the bus. That's okay. But I really wanted to show you those over here. But I'm very happy that these things happen because it means that they're still excavating Masada. What have they done here? Well, a lot of tour guides don't do this. I've met tour guides who come up here for an hour. I don't understand it, but that's what they do. And if you're going to come all the way here from America, all right, now I got a treat for you. Okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to line up from where I'm standing down, close together, facing this way. Okay, put your hands on the rail, face this way, behind me. Now, you will remember, first of all, you figured out already that you're at the southern tip of Masada. This really gives you a clear idea of just how impregnable a fortress this really was. Okay, if you look down all the way to your left, you'll see that we passed up this ravine, way back. Later, when we're in the shade and I'm telling you about how they found water up here, look at the upper level of the cliff, okay? And you see how there's like a path there, the goat path? Okay, so just remember that flash floods would naturally come through there. Just remember that, okay? They would come through the ravine to this cliff, pull down into the valley and pour down, okay? Now what if you could channel that water? You with me so far? What if you could channel that water?
Right.
Now there's another mystery. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Another mystery. So I told you that Elazar ben Yair, they used to yell things down at the Romans, and they used to splash right out of the pool. It all sounds nice when you read it in Josephus, but how did they hear them? How did they hear them all the way down there? It sounds ridiculous. So I'm going to give you a gift. Okay? I told you that the motto in the Israeli army was Metzada lo tipol shuv. Masada will not fall again. So here's what we're going to do, okay? We're going to leave a little piece of us here in Masada, okay? I want you to face that direction, and I'm going to say a word, count to three, one, two, three, and then you all yell the word facing that way. You ready? You ready? Okay? Metzada! One, two, three!
Metzada!
Low! One, two, three!
Low!
No, it's a new word.
Oh, low.
Metzada lo tipol shuv. We'll do it again. Metzada! One, two, three!
Mitzada!
Low! One, two, three!
Low!
Tipo! One, two, three!
Tipo!
We'll fall. Shuv! Again! One, two, three!
Shuv!
Oh my God, that's
amazing. Israelite! One, two, three!
Israelite!
Is that cool?
That's uncanny.
Do it again?
Yeah, wait, please.
Is that cool? All right, this time we're going to do three words together. Am Yisrael Chai. You ready? One, two, three. Am Yisrael Chai. Is that cool?
That is a trip.
So you've just left a piece of you here in Masada forever. Come follow me, dudes. Right, the sound gets captured in the valley and then bounces back. You're facing a direct cliff. So it bounces right back at you. And there's no other sound here in the desert. So it doesn't get warbled. Shin. Right, Leman Yerushalayim. For Jerusalem. He has an interesting thing. At the bottom of the coins, there's always a date. There are two letters, Shin and then another letter, like Shin Aleph. It's Shana Achat, one, year one. So what does that mean, year one? So the rebels minted coins for the same reason the Romans did, and they called it like year one of the Great Revolt, year two of the Great Revolt, right? And up until they found Masada, we had only discovered six coins in the entire Middle East, in all of Israel, that have the letters Shin He. Shin He would be the fifth year of the Revolt, okay? Which were minted by Zealots, but this was after Jerusalem fell. And when they came up here, they found seven more. So there was still a revolt going long after the Romans believed it was over. Here you can see another cistern. Oh, these guys are taking their time. They're going to miss the cable car. Guys!
Hurry up!
Come!
You're going to miss the car!
Oh, yeah. Doesn't it seem like so long ago that we came up the cable car and walked down here?
Yeah.
Left side, guys. It's coming. Alright. Okay, bottom line. You ready for a good story?
Yeah.
Alright, I can't look at you because I'll get a neck ache, so. Alright. Ah. It's a tanug, I'm a zug. Tanug. Alright. Doesn't the Dead Sea always look cooler from inside an air conditioned bus?
Oh, yeah.
Alright. So you guys had a good day?
Yes.
Unbelievable. Great. All right. So just to finish it off, I'll tell you a quick story. Don't want to kill the bus driver here.
Yeah, there you go. Sure.
Wondering whether it's getting cleaner or dirtier now.
That's fine.
All right. So when when I was in officer's course in Kostinim, so we used to, one of the requirements for finishing officer's course is you have to be very proficient at navigations, right? Which in Hebrew is called Nivutim, right? And basically they drop you in the middle of the desert and they give you a map. You have to memorize the map. You're not supposed to open it up. And sometimes at night, sometimes in the day, sometimes all on your own. They drop you in the middle of nowhere. They don't tell you where you are. You have to figure out where you are and then figure out how to get to the beginning of where your trail is. And then you kind of navigate through the desert and you find like all these, you know, codes on rocks and things like that. And at the end you bring them back and they check the codes against the places they gave you and you get scored. And if you fail navigation, you don't become an officer. So it's very stressful, right? And it's not like we were walking in Ein Gedi, like you're kind of this relaxed walk. I mean, you have like, you know, they give you like 4 hours to do like whatever it is, 15 kilometers, and basically you have to like jog it. Or sometimes it's a very fast walk and it's real like, you know, lachatz, pressure, right? Okay. So one day, so they, before you go out on navigations, they give you what's called a tadrich, right? A briefing. And basically it's like all the regulations, all the security issues, things like that. You know, what to do if terrorists attack, what to do if you're attacked by wild dogs. Anybody know what you do if you're attacked by wild dogs? You shoot them. Anyway. Yeah, unless you're a lassie, right? Anyway. So one of the targilim, for example, is if there's a flash flood. Now, I explained to you this morning what a flash flood is. Just to remind you, it's because the desert is basically shale rock, and the water hits the rock. It doesn't get absorbed. It slides, picks up speed. More and more water gathers from the rainfall, heads down towards the desert. So if you see a flash flood, the people who were in Ein Gedi saw a close hand what a flash flood does. Okay? What's the matter? They're davening. Either that or they're baptizing somebody. Anyway, so that reminds me of a funny story. I have to tell you the story. This is a segue from the other story. I once took a group, we were heading up to the Golan, and we stopped...
Wait,
we stopped by the Jordan River. We stopped by the Jordan River, right? And we saw this group baptizing themselves, this birthright group that I had, they really wanted to get water from the Jordan River. And I was making fun of it. I'm like, you know, the Jordan River's not like the Hudson or the Allegheny. I mean, it's a little pisher river. You know, you can step over it, but I... But, you know, Jordan, whatever. Everybody in the group had some Christian friend that wanted holy water, Jordan River. So we get to the water, and there's this group being baptized, right? You know, and there's like one guy in the water with another woman, and she's in white robes, and everybody's on the seashore, like, you know, singing and hallelujahing. And I'm just watching them, and then all these Christians are like gathering water in their bottles, like holy water from the Jordan River. And I look, and about a couple hundred yards upstream, there's an Arab fisherman. And he's standing there, and he's pissing into the water. And it's kind of flowing downstream. And we took this amazing picture. But anyway, back to our original program. So, so one of the things that they do is, you know, they tell you that in the event there's a flash flood, you know, if you're like in a nature reserve like Ein Gedi, and there's a flash flood, then, you know, the rangers come through and they, you know, they make announcements and they find you. But if you're out in the middle of nowhere in the desert and there's a flash flood, how are they going to let you know? So all the different units of soldiers that are doing navigations, they're within a certain, you know, whatever, 20 kilometer radius, whatever it is. And what they do is they start shooting up flares. First of all, you have a radio. And they call you over the radio. And just in case you don't hear it, they shoot up flares, right, of a certain color. Green color for a flash flood, fine. And every time we did a navigation, which was a lot, they would always go through this whole tadrich, you know. Do you have your ammo? Do you have your canteens? Have you memorized your map? Is your sealed map with you in your pouch in case you get lost? You know, what happens if you're attacked by wild dogs? What happens if you run out of ammo? What happens if you get lost? But all these different things, what happens if there's a flash flood, green flare, fine. And very often on when you were on the Evil Team on navigations, they would actually send you like a message over the radio, kind of like, you know, as an exercise to practice to make sure that you remembered. And a couple times they had given us this exercise. Okay, there's a flash flood. There's a flash flood warning, and you have to climb to high ground. Now, when there's a flash flood warning and you get it over the radio, what you have to do is you have to climb 10 meters above like sort of the level of the creek bed. Right, when you navigate, you don't navigate on mountaintops, because then you have to go up and down and up and down. You navigate in the creek beds, because then at least you can walk more or less on flat, and you have to navigate around mountains. So that's very dangerous, because that's where the flash floods come. So if they give you a flash flood warning, you know, you climb up 10 meters, whatever it is, 30 feet. And this happened to us a couple times. And basically, we weren't sure if they were getting just, you know, false warnings, or if they were testing us, whatever. So one day we're doing navigations, me and this other guy. And we're in the middle, not far from Beersheba, at a place called Summit Shoket. And we're doing these navigations, and we get this warning over the radio. Flash flood. And we were standing, mamash, in a place like this, like right below a wall like this. Okay? And the guy, Arik, that I was doing navigation with, he's like, oh my God, there's no way I'm climbing 10 meters up. It's ridiculous. Let's just sit down and we'll wait. And I also thought the whole thing was ridiculous. You're in the middle of a hot day, there's a clear sky. Ridiculous. But then I knew, I'd heard legends, stories, that sometimes they would see a couple of guys navigating, and they would know which group it was, which Sevet, and so they'd watch you in binoculars, and they'd give such a warning just to see if you obeyed orders. And if they would see you through the binoculars not obeying the orders, then you were instantly thrown out of officer's course, right? And we'd heard this happen sometimes, so I said to him, you know what, we've come this far in officer's course, I'm not blowing officer's course just because I don't want to climb 10 meters. It's not worth it. Oh, on your right is a tank. This is a Merkava. You see those little balls and chains hanging from the back of the tank? That's actually a unique invention that the Israelis invented. That is the most sensitive part of the tank. Right? It's the connection between the tuba, which is the main body of the tank, like it drives the tank, and the tsariach, the turret that turns around. And enemy gunners always aim for that spot. It's the weak point. So what they did was they created those balls. If an enemy shell, a tank shell, or an anti-tank weapon is fired at the tank, when it hits those balls, it thinks it's hit the wall of the tank and detonates. And so it prevents it from going through the tank. It's a brilliant invention. Sometimes the simplest things. And that's an incredible... Merkava tank is an incredible machine. But we'll talk about that tomorrow in the Golan, because we'll probably see tanks. But anyway, given and be that as it may. So I say to him, listen, I'm climbing up. You know, don't be an idiot. Let's just climb up. So we're heaving and hoeing, and we've got, you know, our Ephodim, our web gearing on us, whatever. We get to the top, we find this ledge, you know, 30 meters up, and we pull ourselves up, and now we're sitting on this ledge. And now generally what happens is that, you know, they don't give you the whole clear for like 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, and the clock stops. Right? Like if you've got like, I don't know, a 15-mile navigation, and you've got to do it within whatever it is, 6 or 4 hours, whatever, so the clock stops, so you get to rest a little. So, you know, just in case this happens, you always have your emergency kit, which is like, you know, pistachio nuts or garinim. So I pull out my fistukim, you know, pistachio nuts, and we're sitting on the ledge, and we're just, you know, talking, eating pistachio nuts, whatever. And I hear this funny noise. It sounds something like this. Okay? And, you know, don't really notice it. But then the noise starts getting louder. It sounds like this. And, you know, I'm like, what can you do? Right. And I look at Eric, I say, what is that? You know, do you hear this? He goes, yeah, Muslim, what is that? I don't know, it's weird. So we're looking up, we thought it was a plane. We're looking up, and the noise gets louder and louder, and all of a sudden, around the bend of the Vadi that we had just been in, of the creek bed, comes this, I never saw anything like it. It was like a wall of water. It was, I would say, a good 15, maybe 10, 15 feet high. I'll never forget, there was this massive tree trunk that was just being tossed along. Obviously been uprooted, okay? There were a couple of boulders, like what you saw at Engedi, just being thrown around, right? And this incredible rushing wall of water, which must have come all the way up down from the hills in Hebron, where it was raining. By us it was totally sunny. And this thing just came roaring around the bend. I had never seen anything like it. It's like the epitome of the pure, raw power of nature. Just unbelievable. And we're sitting there, and we're just watching this. And, you know, this lasts for about a minute. After about a minute, the water, which is flowing like a river now, there's like a whole river down on the creek bed, which a moment ago was empty, right? And the river starts, you know, it's like a flowing river, and then gradually it slows down, starts to go down and down and down. It took about a half an hour for the water to just totally disappear, so that it was just like, you know, a couple of trickles and glistening water. After about an hour or so, we finally got the all clear to go back down into the valley. And, you know, we got down to the valley bed. I would say about a half an hour after that, the whole creek bed was totally dry. It wasn't even wet. Okay, and mind you, this is in like the February sun. We're not talking July. And, so first of all, just as an aside, I mean, if I had stayed down in that creek bed, I wouldn't be talking to you today. But, or, you know, whatever, it would have been a good swim. But I started to understand for the first time the power of nature. Now, if you look up at these mountain cliffs, so when there are flash floods, the water comes pouring off the cliffs. And actually, I was once up in Masada in the winter, and I hear all these people going, ooh, wow, ah. And I walk over the edge, with the side where we saw the ramp, and up on top of one of those cliffs is this waterfall pouring off the edge of the cliff. Okay? Because it was a flash flood that came to the edge of that cliff. So what King Herod did was very clever. He built canals to catch that water. And he brought that water to the base of Masada, okay, by building canals. And the canals went around the base of Masada and actually caused the water to flow up. Okay? And he also built huge cisterns. Okay, it only rains 4 days a year in the desert, but when it rains, the water on the desert has nowhere to go. So all the water that landed on Masada when it did rain, okay, in other words, there's enough rainfall that falls when it rains, okay, to supply Masada for an entire year. It's just that it all gets lost. So he built canals all over Masada that go around the side of Masada and pour all that water into 8 huge cisterns. One of which, by the way, we saw, we were standing in front of it right when we were in front of the synagogue. Another one that we passed that they were fixing, excavating, we went to the cliff of the screaming, right? It's like a cistern is like a huge cave. They put limestone, they cake the walls in limestone so that it doesn't absorb the water. And they basically fill it up. And you can see steps all the way down into these cisterns. And the walls are smoothed by the water. So you know that in the winter it was full. And that's how they supplied it with water. And eventually what happened was the Romans discovered some of these canals and they destroyed them. Because they realized how, they finally figured out how the Jews were getting water. But they didn't find all of them. The last of them, we think, were destroyed over time because we think that the Byzantine monks who lived up there in the 6th century were still using a couple of Herod's canals. Otherwise, nobody could figure out how they would get water. So they took water off those cisterns. And in the winter, sometimes you can see a little bit of water in a couple of them, but for the most part, it busted out. But that is the mystery of the water of Masada. Anyway, last story for the day. I think over the next 10 minutes, all of you, in one shape or form, are going to slowly start to reach the spiritual moment high of the day, which is when your eyes close and you appreciate the joy of living, which is fine. Enjoy yourselves, all except for Rhea, who we hope doesn't have that experience. And Zell, we should be in Yerushalayim in about, I don't know, 40 minutes, something like that. So we'll wake you up when we get there. And what we're going to do is we're going to make a stop. We're basically going back the way we came. So we're going to make a stop across the street from the old city, you know, so you can just cross over there and go into the old city. And the second stop will be at the Har Tzion Hotel. And I will see you there. We're going to the Golan, Sfat, and then back down to Tveria. If we have time, we might actually manage to take a nature walk. We'll have to see how the traffic is and the timing goes. We'll see. No, we're not going to Amuka. But you can go to Amuka. We can tell you how to get there. You can take a cab and then meet us for dinner. It only costs, I don't know, a few hundred shekels. It's worth it for the right girl, right? Yeah, so Miles wanted another story of Ein Gedi and its biblical significance. So with apologies to the guys who came to Ein Gedi, I'll give it to you real quick. When the first king of Israel, when the Jewish people were in Israel, after the period of the judges, after the Shoftim, was a fellow by the name of Saul. King Saul was in the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, and he was considered an upright, a righteous man, Torah scholar, prophet. And things were going well. He kind of hung out with a prophet by the name of Samuel, Shmuel, and Avi. And one day he got a command. And the command was to wipe out the nation of Amalek. Now, this is a very difficult mitzvah. Amalek is a nation which was set to destroy the Jewish people. They attacked us right after the splitting of the Red Sea from the rear, killing women and children in the back. And it was considered an attack that had no purpose. Aside from the fact that they didn't come to do battle with the soldiers, it wasn't as though they hoped for victory. They just wanted to put the sting. I mean, all the nations of the world, it says, Aznamogu, Kol Yoshvei Kanan, then all the, yeah, you can see the caves up on the left. Then all the nations of Canaan trembled after they heard about the splitting of the sea. So it wasn't like this was an unknown phenomenon. And there's only one nation. They wanted to rain on the parade. And they attacked the Jewish people, even though they had no hope of winning. Never mind the miraculous, they were also much smaller. And so they came to symbolize a nation that rises up to destroy the Jewish people simply because they're Jewish. And so King Saul was, this is now 300 years later, is given the command to destroy them. Now it's hard for us to understand how you could destroy a nation, but theoretically there is a point that evil can reach such a nadir that a nation can become so evil that the world is better off if they're destroyed. The only example I can think of, and we don't have the right to make this assumption, so don't think that I'm saying that this is the case with Germany, but at least I can understand it. If you train enough Hitler youth, and it's the children and the adults, 70 million Germans, I mean, if not all of them, certainly most of them, were active and passive participants in murder. So if a nation reaches that level of destruction, maybe they need to be destroyed. Maybe the world is better off putting an end to that culture. In any event, Saul can't do it. He gets most of it done, and finally the last Amalekite, a fellow by the name of Agag, who's the king, is begging for mercy. To see a proud ruler, a fierce warrior, reduced to begging on his knees for mercy, that's a hard thing. And the Talmud says that the Jewish people are Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim. We're merciful people, born of merciful people. We're not built to be cruel. And as painful as it may sound, sometimes you need to be cruel, you know? And, you know, if you're a doctor and someone's really ill, sometimes you have to amputate a leg. And if you're too merciful on him and you can't bear to do it, you're not doing him a favor. So if you and I came up with this decision, that'd be a dangerous thing. But if God tells you to do something, it must be the right thing to do. Anyway, because he doesn't do that, and because of a couple other things, Samuel tells him that he's lost his kingdom, and that another has been anointed to take his place. But Saul doesn't know who. And technically speaking, if someone else is anointed, then he's a rebel against the king of the royal kingdom, and he's allowed to kill him. So eventually Saul begins to suspect that it's David. David who slayed the bear to protect his flock, who kills Goliath, who's a fierce warrior, who's clearly a spiritual holy person. So Saul decides that David has to die because he has rebelled against Saul and his kingdom. And it says that a ruach ra tafasoto, a bad spirit, which may mean that he became depressed. In any event, David is forced to run. He can't bear to do battle with the person who was once his mentor, whom he loved so much. Remember that Saul's son, Jonathan, was David's closest friend. So David runs into hiding. And he has to go from place to place, and there are all sorts of terrible stories. The whole city of priests is killed because they gave him refuge. And eventually David and his men come down to the desert. And they hide out in a canyon that's called Ein Gedi, the spring of the goats, Al Panei Tsukei Ayalim, right? On the face of the cliffs of the goats, of the ibex. Now, when he's hiding out there one day, King Saul and his men, they track him, and they track him down, and they find his prince. And they start heading up into this ravine to see if they can find David and his men. And it says, Vayered Shaul, and Shaul goes down, King Saul, La'atechet raglav. Now, la'atechet raglav could mean to wash his feet, regular as a foot. But that's a little strange. It could be that he just wanted to get, you know, a little fresh water on his feet, hot day, which fits. I mean, we just walked through the springs of Ein Gedi, some of us, and they can tell you. But it also could mean that, you know, what is a king? I mean, when do you find that a king is all alone? And he goes off to the side of the path. What does a king go to do that would make him leave everybody else behind? He goes to, take a winkle, right? And so David is hiding out on a ledge in a cave above this spring where Saul goes to, let's say, relieve himself. And his men tell him, look, here's your chance. There's Saul, and he's all alone. There are no men protecting him. Let's finish him off and put an end to this. And David sneaks down behind King Saul, who's a little preoccupied, and he has his knife, and he could kill Saul, but he can't do it. To kill the king of Israel, to kill his mentor, to kill him in the back, while he's relieving himself, he just can't do it. And the presence of King Saul was apparently awe-inspiring. So in the end, David cuts the corner of the coat of King Saul, climbs back up on the cliff. When he gets back up on the cliff, he turns down, and he calls out to Saul. And he says, ho, Let he to whom the corner of this coat belongs, let him tell me that God should judge between us. Yishpat Hashem b'ni u'v'inecha. Let God judge between us. What wrong have I done you? What has been so terrible? And Saul looks up and he realizes that David could have killed him. He sees his coat is cut. And what's interesting is that Samuel, the prophet, told Saul, right? Yikatea knaf me'il, the corner of your kingdom, the corner of the court of your kingdom has been cut off. And so Saul also sees this as a sign. And in that day, although it doesn't last and there are other stories to follow, but in that moment, Saul has a moment of clarity and with tears streaming down his face realizes that his beloved son, because a student is like a son, is right. And he begs him for forgiveness and he blesses him with peace and he turns his men around and they leave. Now Saul would have captured David and most probably would have killed him because that was a ravine that they easily would have captured them in, dead end. And because of a simple act of kindness and respect, David was saved, and the kingdom and the kingship, the royal line of King David, survived. And of course we have a tradition that one day Mashiach ben David, the Messiah, the king, that will hopefully one day be anointed, the temple which will be rebuilt, harmony, peace, love, joy. You know, we don't just mourn for a temple, it's not just a building. It's that once upon a time there was a place where all Jews could come to be together. There was no reform section in the temple, there was no conservative, no orthodox section in the temple. It was just a place, there was a place where brothers could just sit together, right? It doesn't say that they could all agree or they all would go to the same synagogue. It just says there was a place where all the brothers could just be together. And all that hopefully will come to pass one day because a long time ago, David had mercy on King Saul. Now, if you look at the topography of the map in this area and the springs that are here, unless a spring dried up and another one came, the only spring in this area that fits that description is actually Engedi. And that's a name that survived. The Arabs, the Bedouin, kept that name. And they, you know, sort of kept it alive by passing down these names from father to son. And that's how we know that that's Engedi. And if that's so, and it makes sense to me that it's so, then King David walked in that valley. Like four of you today sat where David HaMelech actually sat, which is just mind-boggling. And by the way, now today the ibex have returned, and you can see these goats sometimes sort of flying across the face of the cliffs like, you know.
Wild goats?
Unbelievable.
Wild.
Well, they're semi-wild because they're contained in a nature reserve, but they are wild goats, yeah. Yeah, I became curious about this because we got ambushed. And, a long story, but it was the only time, you know, usually you get into a firefight, everybody's shooting, somebody ends up dead, you don't really know who killed them. This time, you actually kill someone, you actually take out the terrorist. That's a different experience, to know you've killed someone. Yeah, like I would not be allowed, I won't be allowed to help build a mission. If they come, if Mashiach comes tomorrow, and they decide to build the Beis HaMikdash, I won't be allowed to help build it. Because I've killed people. It doesn't matter there was a mitzvah, it doesn't matter there was, you know, that I think it was the right thing to do, to stop terrorists from doing so. If you've taken a human life, you don't build a temple. It affects you. The temple has to be built from a different energy, purer energy. Pardon? Yeah, you can go to the temple. Got to do a little purifying, but yeah. Listen, when they start building the temple, we're going to sit up on Israelite's roof. I figure that's when Israelite will do its best fundraising. We'll sell tickets. Yeah. Best view in town.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2- 627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.